Happy Friday to you. It is Friday, May 4th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Friday in the 3 o'clock hour, it's the Federal News Countdown. This week, no exception. And my experts in the world of the federal government choosing the three most important federal news stories of the week are two friends of the show. Karen Evans, former eGov administrator, is here, and it is great to see you as always. And I appreciate your stories, and I appreciate you being here.
Well, I'm excited. This is my first Federal News Countdown for the week.
Yes, you were on with Mark Forman the last week of 2011.
That's right.
And we did the IT stories for the entire year of 2011. Was this easier or harder?
I think this was also, it was a little bit easier, but this happened to be a week with a lot of really great news stories.
Yes, that is true, and you've chosen three great ones. Your counterpart on the Federal News Countdown is Dan Chenick, senior fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government, and unfortunately Dan is learning, well, not learning for the first time, I'm sure, but experiencing what all of us have experienced, which is that Washington, D.C. is difficult to get around in. So Dan assures me that he'll be here in just a few minutes to join us, but we're going to start, as we always do, with...
Number three!
And Karen, your third most important federal news story of the week is from the Huffington Post. And I wonder if the headline of this story is a rhetorical question. It is, does anyone in Congress get technology? What do you think?
Well, actually, that... So don't get upset. That was my number one story.
Well, we have them in reverse.
You
All
have
right.
them
well,
in reverse. Well, this has them right. So this says number three, which was from the Huffington Post, which is Google Street View in Israel, tourists versus terrorists.
Now, the whole idea of Google Street View is just, it makes some people absolutely bananas because of the idea that anything or anyone could show up in Google
That's
Street
right.
View at any time.
But it's also, so this is, to me, this is the heart, and it gets to the heart of the issue of information sharing, like how much sharing is too much sharing. And so you can understand why Google has the Street View and is going down, because if you really want to use the power of the devices, then you want to have the most up-to-date information. Because I know when I'm lost, and I'm sure you've used your handheld when you're lost,
yes.
that you want that data, especially if you're in a different city or whatever, so that you can get where you need to go. But this puts a very interesting view on it, because it's talking about how Google Street View now is moving out globally, right, and how it's moving out to other countries. And this particular article is talking about how Google had to work out its agreement with Israel. And when you think about, okay, this is a twist on it, because all this information is publicly available. And when this goes back to September 11th, because I remember we had the big push during the Clinton administration to put everything on the web. Everything went out on the web. And then after September 11th, when you started looking at the data that everybody had compiled from publicly available data, we went totally the other way, taking everything off. So I think we're at the point now, because of the way technology has evolved, that the pendulum is swinging back. And I'm hoping that we get to the point where what is reasonable information sharing and how much do you want out there, and this opt-in, opt-out type of approach.
But who winds up deciding what the public should be able to access, even if the decision-making process is totally innocuous? Who decides, well, this is something that somebody might care about at some point, or
well,
might
so
want to have access to?
And that's the heart of this article. And so I am going to do a little plug for this group, that this initiative that I'm involved now, which is called safegov.org. And it's an online forum talking about cloud policies, because this falls right underneath it, because who should decide that? That is a really good policy question. And that really should be debated, because our country is very focused on the individual, right? So the individual opts in. Your privacy is all tied up to you. That's the reason why we have all of these agreements, ACL, all these different things that are out there, right? So we're very individual focused. But the way Google Street View works, if you're out on the street, you're fair game, because it's like taking the view of everything that's out on the street.
And I don't even necessarily know that it's happening to
that's
have
right.
an opportunity to opt out if I wanted to, or even, you know, to hold a bag in front of my face.
That's right. And so, you know, I could see where technology could evolve, that if I'm holding a handheld device and a Google Street View comes down, wouldn't it be cool to have a mobile app that goes beep, 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 there's a Google View camera in? turn the stuff off and so that you can get or put a block to block the signal so that it can at least block the little place where you're at. I mean, I can see where technology would evolve that would allow an individual to be able to at least control maybe the signal that's around them. And I think that that would be a cool way for technology to go, because then you could have the best of both worlds.
This article mentions what you said a few moments ago, and to quote this piece from Anav Silverman on the Huffington Post, but Israeli government approval for Google Street View did not come easy. Prior to the launch, Google consulted with Israeli security officials for months in light of concerns that terrorists could use the services to target citizens. And that's kind of the same thing that Google ran into in the United States. People in the Pentagon found out that there were pictures, views of military bases available. Some questions about whether you could really see anything that was actionable or not. But at least the idea that somebody who maybe you didn't want to know the landscape and the look of a particular area ahead of time would be able to find that information, it made people a little queasy here, and it looks like the same thing in Israel.
Oh, absolutely. And then think about how they live with this every day. So, you know, do you really want to be able to pinpoint locations? I mean, when you start looking at the history of the information that we had available on webs, they actually had, you know, layouts of army bases, and so you could actually figure out where the head of the base was because the plans were out there and then you could look at it. So think about the aerial views that are available. And I was just discussing this the other day with a parent who was getting an iPhone for their kid, and we were talking about how my child has no privacy because I totally track them through everything. And we were talking about how I actually zeroed down through a satellite picture and said, no, you're behind the building at the school. Get back into school. And I could see them move off and go back into school. So, yeah, she has no privacy. That's great. But when she's, like, older, that's not going to be, you know, a good thing.
Right.
And so these are the types of things that I think society now has to really balance about. It's great when you're a parent, but when can you stop it and how do you control those things?
I need to get that app on my son's iPhone.
Oh, it's great.
We'll talk about that during the break. My guest on the Federal News Countdown this week is Karen Evans. Dan Chenick joining us shortly. Karen's third most important federal news story of the week is headlined Google Street View in Israel, Tourists versus Terrorists. And you can read it and all of our stories linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The Federal News Countdown continuing in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Using government personal property can save taxpayers millions of dollars. It's also a requirement that federal agencies acquire excess personal property first before purchasing new items. If you're wondering how to acquire excess personal property or transfer your agency's excess personal property, turn to GSA at gsa.gov/reusecmp. GSA offers programs and online tools such as GSA Access to help reuse and recycle items ranging from office equipment and furniture to computers, scientific devices, heavy machinery, airplanes, boats, and much more. Let GSA help you get the most out of the government's resources while saving money and protecting the environment. Remember, when you no longer need it, someone else does. For more information on reusing and recycling your excess personal property, visit GSA at gsa.gov/reusecmp. gsa.gov/reusecmp. That's gsa.gov/reusecmp.
Mark Herman from Booz Allen Hamilton commented during the panel discussion titled The Cloud as a Shroud, Fraud in a Digital Age, brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton.
The commodity availability of scalable storage and processing nodes, basically on demand, has made it economically feasible to expand the scope of data evaluated in real time or in near real time. And these allows you to make timely and actionable conclusions.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen.
Information is flowing from more sources than ever before. Cloud-enabled enterprises can collect and analyze terabytes of data by leveraging the new technology. They can rapidly analyze an entire data set, developing deeper insights than what could be gained from looking at only a portion of the data, thus enabling better decisions made much faster. Booz Allen Hamilton believes secure, scalable, and automated cloud-based solutions can help derive actionable information transformation faster. Count on Booz Allen to help you be ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
Military families make great sacrifices so that we can be safe, secure, and free. That's why we at United Health Military and Veteran Services are so honored to have been selected to serve families in the TRICARE West region starting in April 2013. United Healthcare serves over 78 million Americans nationwide. We have the experience and expertise to make healthcare better for our servicemen and women and their families. United Healthcare's expansive network provides access to hundreds of thousands of physicians and specialists. We focus on making it possible for healthcare teams to work together and share important information about your care. And at United Healthcare, we use innovative technologies to make sure you get the right care from the right doctor for your needs. Military families help keep us safe. So at United Healthcare, helping military families isn't just a job, it's an honor. To learn more, visit UnitedHealthMilitary.com.
I'm Emily Kopp. Coming up on Monday's Federal Drive, USDA's top food inspector defends a plan to speed up poultry checks. And we help kick off Public Service Recognition Week with a new series honoring feds who do good. We'll take a look at the finalists for the Service to America Awards. Lots more, too, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit FederalNewsRadio.com.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Federal News Countdown, featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week. And we have our full complement of guests in studio now. Karen Evans, of course, former eGov administrator, is in studio with me. And I'm happy to welcome Dan Chenick, senior fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Good to see you.
Thank you, Francis. I'm very happy to be here. And I'm always happy to be anywhere that Karen is.
That's very diplomatic of you to say. Now, we talked about Karen's number three story, and very quickly I want to mention your third most important federal news story of the week. It's from NextGov. The headline is Big Data Could Remake Science and Government. My fear, Dan, is that big data is going to turn into one of these buzzwords like cloud computing and on and on and on, and it loses the impact and the meaning potentially that it might have for agencies.
Right. The reason I thought this story was interesting is that we've talked a lot about big data and analytics as a way to improve payments or make government more efficient. This story was about some of the research that's being done to think about how data and analysis can have longer-term impacts on government and society. The work that the researchers are doing that's cited here at the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, or the PCAST, as some of your listeners may know it, is looking at the administration's initiative on big data, is trying to take a step back and think about how in this world of analytics and data sets that are coming in from all different places, cloud, mobile, lots of ability to connect data that we didn't have before, how can that create new opportunities that are fundamentally different than what we've seen before?
I don't want to short shrift your second most important story, which we'll get to in a moment, but one more question on this. What factor is data hygiene play in this when you're pulling data from so many different places and potentially different sources?
So it's interesting. On the one hand, pulling data introduces more sources of error. But on the other hand, think about Wikipedia. There are so many different inputs into a story or into an entry that there's a self-correcting mechanism. So if you think about lots of different pieces of data, it's almost like there's going to be a gathering toward some ground level of truth that there might not have been otherwise if you only relied on a single source. So that's not to say that that will always happen, but over time, I tend to think that analytics will lead to a more accurate result without agencies or individuals having to go through lots of data cleansing.
All right. Your third most important story is from NextGov. The headline is Big Data Could Remake Science and Government, and it is certainly something that we'll keep an eye on, and as we learn more about how agencies are going to deal with big data, I'll look forward to getting your input on that, Dan. Your second most important story of the week is from The Atlantic, and the headline is Stand Your Cyber Ground, a novel proposal for digital security. The idea of privacy and cybersecurity and all of it rolled into one in this piece. Talk about what appealed
really
to you.
I really like
here.
This piece. It sort of brings back, you know, Jonathan Swift and A Modest Proposal and how do we deal with something real. What this is saying is that there are companies that are out there every day right now who are combating cyber threats and have been for some time, and doing so in ways that they would benefit more from, and that's some of the discussion with Congress and the administration about how much information sharing should occur in the cyber realm. This article, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think it's an interesting hypothesis, says that companies ought to have more authority in the cyber realm to basically respond without fear of legal retraction or response from governments, because their money, the money of people that are investing in those companies, is going out the door every day. And just like a company would post a security guard at its front door, that it ought to be able to post a cyber guard and not have the fear of retribution from government if it takes an action against somebody who would come in and do the cyber equivalent of a bank robbery.
Now, the loss of data and the mixture of cybersecurity and privacy, this is an intersection that's been really hard for agencies to pin down for a long time. And what Dan's talking about here and what this piece talks about, too, is what that looks like in the private sector.
And this has always been it's a great debate. And so that's why I thought this was really interesting, because, as you know, I do stuff through the camps. And we had some European companies mm-hmm. that were there, and they really view the way that we want to do certain things in cybersecurity as very antiquated, very just really authoritative. And so in debating with him at the camp in front of these folks, one of the questions I asked is, I said, okay, if you came up to my house and my house was clearly posted, and then you broke into my house and you were inside my house carrying out my goods, I have a right to protect myself. And he said, that's totally different. I said, it is not different if you're in a company within a company's assets and you're carrying off their intellectual property. They have a right to protect their intellectual property. And he said, no, they don't, which I thought was an interesting view. He said, it has a right to be out there to be free so that other people can look at it. I said, not if I have stockholders investing in me. Mm-mm. So it really, mm-hmm. they can see it in the physical world, but in the virtual world, a lot of people are still really debating where is the line of demarcation and who owns what.
I wonder why that is, because that seems to me to be fairly clear, fairly evident. Well, if I develop something just because I've stored it on a hard drive rather than storing it on a shelf because it's a physical object I've created.
Yeah, I think it's a reflection of the newness of this field in terms of forensics, detection, response. You know, we've had 3,000 years of law that's been built up around physical protection of assets in the home and in people's businesses. We've had about 20 years of experience and very little law and just about zero case law around what happens when companies in a corporate setting try to defend themselves against cyber intrusion. And it's something that people, and especially attorneys and ethics counsel with companies and with governments, try to think about a lot in terms of what are the rules of the road. It also crosses over into the law of war in cybersecurity. So if a foreign adversary is coming in and trying to attack the U.S. government, it might try to attack an agency. It also might try to attack a large company like any one of a number of large companies or several. What is the company's response in working with the government on that? And there's not a good, rational, well thought through set of policies to address that situation.
The closest parallel that I can think of is the cases that the Recording Industry Association of America brought against people that it accused of making copies of MP3 files, sharing music. And they were trying to bring cases, asking people to pay thousands and thousands of dollars per song in damages for something that you download for 99 cents from iTunes or wherever it is that you get music. And so maybe part of the lack of clarity about this is that the case law that does exist are cases like that, where it's easy to look at it and go, well, yeah, maybe they deserve some protection, but what they're asking for as far as protection is pretty ridiculous.
Well, and in that particular case, and those have come up several times, right, because the reaction is to ban the technology. And then, you know, the parallel to this, and I know this is going to be controversial here, is that it's the use of technology, and people always then do the analogy of guns, right? And you could get into the whole thing here about it's not the gun, but it's the use of the gun and the person who's doing things that the way that this works. And I know when all of this came up at one point when I was the CIO at Energy, they wanted to ban certain technologies because they wanted to prevent file sharing. So the recording industry had mounted this huge thing associated with this. And we were like, that's to move big data, you know, back to Dan's other piece about big data. These are researchers. They need to have an efficient way to be able to move data legitimately. You're talking about people using technology for illegitimate purposes. They know, so this really comes down to education and what's right and what's wrong. I mean, there's a difference when some of the kids grow up and think, oh, I'm just sharing a song. Everybody shares a song. This one that you saw this with cassette tapes. Remember when people were making copies of cassette? Well, it's just one song, you know, and so that, but because of the way this technology works, it's huge dollars now. It's not like I have to go over to somebody's house and pop it into the cassette player.
Also, one quick point. I think there's a difference from an intellectual property perspective. I'm not an IP attorney. But from an arts perspective, the protection of the creative arts ability of people to basically make money in that field is not the same thing as a hacker or a foreign adversary or a nation state coming in and actually exfiltrating or stealing things from within a company's firewall.
But I think for a lot of people, I wonder if the intellectual process of justification isn't similar, that somebody like the person Karen was talking to comes to that conclusion based on that kind of progression of ideas. I guess that's kind of where I was headed
with that. In one sense, it's an information dissemination problem or an information sharing problem in terms of the ubiquitous sharing of music. On the other hand, it's sort of a bilateral, I'm breaking into your house or your cyber house, I'm taking your stuff, as opposed to I'm looking at all the stuff that's out there. And, you know, I agree with you, there's a similarity, but I think that there's more of a difference of degree than of kind.
I get your point, and I appreciate this selection. Dan Chenick's second most important federal news story of the week is from The Atlantic, and you can read it and linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The Federal News Countdown continuing with Karen Evans' second most important federal news story of the week in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
At Kaiser Permanente, we carefully select our doctors so you can carefully select your doctors. Our hiring process is so selective, only 1 in 10 doctors who apply make the cut. Yes, we're uber picky. Probably have a little perfectionism complex in there, but by putting our doctors under the microscope, we've discovered some of the greatest medical minds in their fields, and that's led to an even greater medical breakthrough. Drumroll, please. Award-winning care. We've received many of the highest possible rankings in member satisfaction, patient safety, overall quality of care, and more. But we're not the only ones reaping the rewards. Because we carefully select our doctors, you have great doctors to choose from. And with all those great doctors, you think it'd be easy. But try choosing just one for your primary care doctor. We'll let you create your own highly selective process for that. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we're here to help you thrive. Visit us at kp.org.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
To win and deliver government health care contracts successfully, you need to align with the right teaming partners. Moreover, with over 900 healthcare IT initiatives proposed in the 2013 federal budget, you need to begin building your healthcare IT teams now. Meet Tech Systems. Every year, Tech Systems deploys thousands of IT professionals at over 5,500 client sites nationwide, including more than 65 government agencies. Tech Systems Government Services offers a dedicated healthcare division to deliver practical healthcare IT solutions to the federal, state, and local government. No matter where you are on your meaningful use journey, Tech Systems can guide you through the transition. From providing managed services that tailor end-user training by role and workflow, to providing BI solutions that get you closer to your quality care goals. Tech Systems, our people make IT possible. Learn more at techsystems.com. TEKSystems.com.
Hey, everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast, Sunday, May 6th. Join us live at 11 as Foodie and the Beast dives way deep into the Chef Wars at Pearl Dive, Jeff Black's hot new restaurant on 14th Street. Pearl Dive's a hell of a seafood restaurant, but that Sunday, Jeff is challenging some of D.C.'s finest chefs to a chicken fried steak contest. Say what? Bertrand Barley's Kyle Bailey, Michelle Richard, The Source's Scott Druneau, Victor Albizo, and Bourbon Steak's Adam Sobel will take on Jeff as our esteemed panel of judges decides the winner and you enjoy libations and great taste from Pearl Dive. For tickets and info, visit pearldivedc.com.
The Effects of Bullying, from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Kids who are bullied are at increased risk of being depressed. They're more likely to have sleep problems and lower academic scores. This is especially true for kids who are bullied on a regular basis. Marcy Hertz is a health scientist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
They're also more likely to miss school or to drop out of school. You can understand if they're being bullied at school, they're less likely to go to school then and be victimized.
If a child is being bullied,
the first step I would encourage them to do is to reach out to the school counselor or social worker, if there is one, to get assistance and in terms of mental health support.
You can learn how to take action against bullying and prevent it from happening at stopbullying.gov. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
In the beloved fairy tale Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly 1 in 3 children in America are overweight or obese. Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov, brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Ad Council.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features two experts in the world of the federal government every week, choosing their three most important federal news stories of the week, ranking them in order, and counting them down with me in the 3 o'clock hour every Friday. My guests today are Dan Chenick, Senior Fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government, and former eGov Administrator Karen Evans. And I'm going to give the singers the rest of the show off today because we're kind of jumbled up. Now, Karen, your second most important federal news story is the same as Dan's most important. So that story is our Jason Miller's coverage on federalnewsradio.com of the shared services deadline story. Now, I guess my first question for you, Karen, is Dan chose this number one. This is a big story. It's one of the biggest stories of the week as far as just hits go, numbers of readers on federalnewsradio.com. So you didn't choose it number one, and I wonder, I know why, I think, but maybe you can confirm for me. I'm guessing because it ties into the story you actually chose at number one.
It does tie into my story that I chose as number one, so we can keep everybody in suspense.
Okay.
Okay, but the reason why I picked it, obviously, as number two is because it is a big story. The other reason why I didn't pick it necessarily as number one, and I did go back and forth over this, is because, to me, this has been in the works. So it's not like, woo, it came out of the blue. It's just that it happened to be released during the week that we're doing it, which is great. And so when I started looking through it, I said, okay, it needs to be in the top three. And how do I rank it based on all the other things that are going on this week? So you knew, I told you that I really try to build my pieces up, and I really think about how I build out what's number one, what's number two.
You put so much thought into this, and I love it every single time.
And I have
time.
My little backup package for anything that he was going to ask me. I have my little
This
pads.
Is the same material that she had when she walked around at OMB, right, Dan?
Oh, well, I worked with Karen at OMB for several months, and then for several years while Karen was the CIO Council Vice Chair and I was at OMB. And, Karen was always the most prepared person in any meeting.
Now, there are a ton of deadlines in this release, Dan. Are these deadlines makeable, do you think? Do the agencies have enough time to hit all of these?
Well, so the deadlines are not unachievable. I mean, they're basically, some agencies have done a great job in terms of shared services migration. OPM with the HR line of business, which actually started when Karen was there, the Air Force with financial management and HR now, the Federal Aviation Administration, which is doing a broad scope IT procurement and finance and logistics modernization. Other agencies are less far along. OMB, since long before Karen and I were there, has used these sort of rolling deadlines as a way to get agencies to pay attention, not just to a policy memo, but to taking a set of actions over time. And that's really what they've tried to do here is build up, identify two programs by March, submit a revised enterprise roadmap, which is really an updating of their architecture to reflect their shared services migration in terms of IT, the IT architecture and IT consolidation. Complete the two shared service initiatives in 2012. Obviously, the agency has the definitional ability to say what does complete look like in March, and most of them will probably set themselves some achievable goal. But as we've seen in many OMB memos, not every agency makes it, and it's part of the art and science of management and oversight to basically cajole agencies along. The goal here is to get the whole ship moving more quickly. Some parts of it's a bad analogy. Some parts of the ship will move faster than others. So you'll end up with a misshapen ship. But the goal is to get the whole thing to move more quickly.
What do you see when you see these, when you look at these deadlines, this timeline, Karen?
Well, to me, I think they are very doable, because if you look at everything that the administration has laid out, what this is doing is bringing it all together so that it's integrating all these different pieces. And that's really what needs to be done, because when you talk a lot of times, if you have an agency that isn't necessarily as far along as like VA or FFA, FAA, and the things that they've been doing because they've been working at it, right, then what this does is really help map it out and gives them a target with the deadline of saying you need to think about what you've been doing here in the tech stats, and you need to be thinking about the shared first and the data consolidation, and how does cloud help you with your data center consolidation to get to the two shared services. And, by the way, you had this whole big foundational activities that you've been doing that you should have been doing all along because those were your statutory responsibilities. Now we're going to modernize those and bring them into share first, mobility first, mm-hmm. those types of things like that, because it all needs to be updated. When you look at it, if you look at when Mark started this back when Dan was in there, it's 10 years old. So it needs to be updated. Everything has changed. I mean, just based on the stories that we're picking today, big data analytics, if that's where you're going, you're going to change what your roadmap strategy is, what you're going to buy, what you're going to do, how you're going to do things. And you should be looking at that.
The other thing this does is it helps the government move more toward where the rest of the world is going. I mean, if you think about everything you're doing in your personal life, whether it's Google Documents or online banking, it's everything as a service. And it's not just back office IT. It's how you live your life every day. And that can include, checking on Craigslist or consumer reports online for things where you're getting information in as a service or activities that you would do in your daily life. And it's basically translating that to what the government does every day, whether it's making payments or collecting information or providing benefits to constituents. It's being done through service-oriented approaches.
Dan Chenick's most important federal news story of the week and Karen Evans' second most important story of the week are Jason Miller's coverage of shared services headline, OMB gives agencies 4 months to figure out shared services. We'll talk about this a little bit more when we come back from the break on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Are you ready to take a leadership role in your public service or nonprofit career? Become a leader at the forefront of modern government practices with a Master of Public Administration degree from Central Michigan University in Alexandria. This unique program is enriched with international content, a vital element in today's global economy. CMU's Master of Public Administration degree is NASPAA certified and the gold standard degree for public administrators.
I would recommend if you work in local, state, or federal government and you're interested in learning about management, organizational leadership, this is definitely a good program. It's a very strong program.
Learn how you can prepare for senior leadership positions with Central Michigan University's adult-friendly Master of Public Administration degree taught right here in Alexandria. Classes will be held at CMU's Alexandria Center. Go to cmich.edu/metrodc. That's cmich.edu/metrodc for more information or call 877-679-1268. Central Michigan University in Alexandria. Quality degrees, convenient formats. Certified operate by CHEV.
The long-anticipated retirement tsunami may finally be coming to fruition in the federal government. Retirement applications are up in 2012, and the number of feds calling it quits in 2011 was at a 10-year high. Federal News Radio examines what agencies are doing to make up for the loss of institutional knowledge at leadership levels. Plus, experts weigh in on whether current budget restrictions will impact recruiting. Read our exclusive report at federalnewsradio.com. Search retirement.
Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Hear from the top of the food chain on how your agency is using technology today. Tech Tuesday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
FederalNewsRadio.com, your one-stop shop for all things federal. Listen daily to interviews with federal managers and government contractors. Read Mike Causey's daily federal report, or just stop by for an update on the latest news affecting the federal community. FederalNewsRadio.com, your source for federal news now.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Federal News Countdown this week, featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Dan Chenick and Karen Evans. And Karen's number two story and Dan's number one are my colleague's colleague Jason Miller's story, headlined OMB Gives Agencies 4 Months to Figure Out Shared Services. Kind of a funny story. The person that I know that works in industry sent me an email this week when right after Jason's story came out, and it was snide, I guess is the word for it. And oh, there's nothing new here, and this is something that's been in the works for a long time, and this is the started with the Bush administration, and on and on and on. And it wasn't political; it wasn't a criticism of the administration for any political reasons. It was more a criticism of they're making a big deal out of this, and it's not new. It's they're building on what's been done before. And my response to that was, well, isn't that the point? When somebody does something. Your friend and colleague Jeff Cook was on the show yesterday talking about the fact that the very basics for this, the foundations for this were laid back in the Clinton administration, that this is not even something Karen and you would never say the Bush administration takes credit for this either. This work has been ongoing for a long time. And isn't that the point of good governance? Somebody has a good idea. Another administration builds on it, and another administration builds on top of that. I thought that's what everybody was complaining about, that we don't have enough of anymore in Washington.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And at the same time, each administration has made significant advances, whether, as Karen referred to, the creation of the lines of business, really the driving of the lines of business into the architecture, which Karen championed in the second half of the Bush administration. I would see that this is sort of a yet another step function. The way that I think this is different is that it drives within an agency into the core of its programs. So whereas the cross-agency lines of business were about agencies sharing with each other, which really kind of jump-started that way, this is about getting agencies to look at their base of operations. You know, when we talk about all the e-gov initiatives and lines of business, it's still like 5-10%, even if you're generous. Of all the IT spend and all the program spend. This is really talking about get into the agency's base spending, do it more effectively because we don't have enough money to do it otherwise, number one. And number two, look at all these companies. My company, IBM, GE, lots of companies that have gone through these major internal transformations with a lot of cost savings over several years. This is telling agencies to do the same thing.
Now, Karen, you and I were talking earlier about the idea that the budget situation will force a lot of agencies to do things that they might not have otherwise been willing to sign on to do. Do you see elements of that here?
Oh, absolutely. That's why I'm really excited about this. I mean, if you look at it in the person who wrote to you, we were building the foundations for it, but the timing was okay. But there wasn't the drive for the need to do the analysis that Dan is talking about, and then you look downward and then upward and then across. So the piece that is really exciting in here is the idea of the portfolio stats, because we were always talking about you have to do portfolio management. You have to look down, you have to look up, and you have to look across. So the budget situation is really going to force that holistic view of your piece in relationship to the federal government as a whole. And if you're doing so, for example, I know Mark Forman was on talking with Jason about the study that Senator Coburn did with the duplication of the 34 programs cross-board, right? This is going to force that about, okay, how should the government really provide that service? And do we really need to have that many agencies doing it? So when the agency looks down, they could say, oh, XYZ agency does it better than me. This is one where I could let it go, maybe partner with them in a shared service, and I can get more focused on the things that are core to our department and agency. Budget situation is forcing that look, and for you to really manage a portfolio.
And it gives, I guess, agencies a good excuse to give up some turf that maybe in the past they wouldn't have been willing to do because, well, we do this, and this is an important part of our mission, and on and on and on. But in a budget situation where you can say, okay, Dan, here, you take this, and you can run with that because you are doing it well, and I can kind of reclaim some of that money.
Mm-hmm. And it drives it into, if you notice the deadlines, August 31st, 2012 is a week before the agencies submit their FY14 budget submission. So the timing of this really drives it into budget planning and require and calls on agencies who are first, when they do the budget, for the most part, they're looking at within their own enterprise when they actually develop the budgets that they present to OMB. Then during the fall, unless they're an enlightened agency or there's already a pre-existing sharing mechanism where there's a program, a joint program or something like that, during the fall, they get into the puts and takes and trades across agencies as budgets develop. So this gets them thinking about shared services in their own house, which can then feed into shared services across the government.
The most important federal news story of the week as selected by Dan Chenick, and the second most important federal news story of the week as selected by Karen Evans, is my colleague Jason Miller's story headlined OMB Gives Agencies 4 Months to Figure Out Shared Services. It's on linked up on the homepage now at federalnewsradio.com, and it's also on the in-depth page as well. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week as selected by Karen Evans on the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Federal Drive is sponsored by Learning Tree International.
Learning Tree International is the number one provider of IT classroom training to the federal government. They provide high-quality, instructor-led IT and management training to government professionals and contractors at all levels. Call 1-800-THE-TREE or enroll today at learningtree.com/gov. That's learningtree.com/gov.
The Federal Drive, brought to you by Learning Tree International, airs weekday mornings from 6 to 10 and online at federalnewsradio.com.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon.
Reusing government personal property can save taxpayers millions of dollars. It's also a requirement that federal agencies acquire excess personal property first before purchasing new items. If you're wondering how to acquire excess personal property or transfer your agency's excess personal property, turn to GSA at gsa.gov/reusecmp. GSA offers programs and online tools such as GSA Access to help reuse and recycle items ranging from office equipment and furniture to computers, scientific devices, heavy machinery, airplanes, boats, and much more. Let GSA help you get the most out of the government's resources while saving money and protecting the environment. Remember, when you no longer need it, someone else does. For more information on reusing and recycling your excess personal property, visit GSA at gsa.gov/reusecmp. gsa.gov/reusecmp. That's gsa.gov/reusecmp.
Adobe Acrobat Pro is actually used very commonly for PDF archiving. If you've got a lot of files of different formats and different types, if you just save these files in all these different formats, then 20 years later, somebody wants to look at the file, they'd actually have to have the program that could open up that file. So for digital archiving, you'd rather have a standardized file format.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Registration is now open for the all-new Management of Change event, featuring interactive sessions around cloud, mobility, and security, and a future technology expo, June 3rd through 5th at the Hyatt Regency, Cambridge, Maryland. This government industry training forum is hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council. Register and learn more at actgov.org/managementofchange. That's actgov.org/managementofchange.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, it's Karen Evans and Dan Chenick. And Karen, your most important federal news story of the week is from Huffington Post. The headline is, "Does anyone in Congress get technology?" And I wonder if that's not, there are a lot of people that would argue that that's a rhetorical question or comedic in some way.
Well, that's why it caught my eye in the first place. And so when I read through it and I thought, wow, this is really the essence of why I took over as the eGov administrator, why I wanted to do things, why I wanted to make technology and work with technology and help agencies and the federal government bring things back to the people. And when you read this article, it's really very neat how Congressman Issa is using technology to go out and really have a dialogue with the American people over things that he's proposing. Now, whether, you know, you agree with what he's proposing or not, that's a different issue, but he's actually engaging in a conversation.
The openness and transparency idea is one that a lot of people have talked about, both sides of the aisle and so on. I wonder why you think it's been difficult for others. Because what Congressman Issa is doing is, it's the basics of interaction with citizens through social media, Dan.
Well,
but it's very effective, and people are responding to it, as this article indicates. People are responding to it just tremendously, it seems.
I would argue that it almost brings us back 200 years to the ability of a citizen legislator to have an impact, because at the beginning of the country, the government was small enough that, you know, people knew their congressmen going to – they didn't talk much more than 6 months because people traveled by horse. But there was definite input from a lot of different individuals into the process of government. And now we've got technology that Congressman Issa and Josh Lamell is a friend. I'm glad, Karen, that you picked this story. Congressman Issa, other members have done similar things. It's something where when we were talking 10 years ago about the eGov – evolution over time. It started really with transactions, but we always talked about eventually we want to really get into digital democracy and policy development, and that's why regulations.gov was a first indicator of that. And now you're seeing Congress doing more of it. You're seeing groups like the Center for Democracy and Technology who've set up publicly shared development of legislation through a website and through wikis. And I think you'll see more and more of that.
The potential for exchange of information, the idea that somebody, as you said, Dan, could engage someone that 2 or 3 years ago, 5 years ago for sure, you would have thought, well, there's no way the chairman of this committee would ever pay any attention to me. And I know that Congressman Issa follows me on Twitter, so I at least have a potential if I see something that I think is important, and it has the potential to get in front of his eyes. Now, that's not my goal, but it certainly is now an achievable goal for people who want to try to get on somebody's radar screen like that.
Well, and it really changes the dynamic. You know, normally you would do a writing campaign, or you would call, or you would do stuff, and so what this is showing is that he's actively engaged. And the piece that that this is highlighting is that it's a two-way communication, to your point. And I always use that as an example about if eGov was successful, it would be digital democracy. The idea of a town square is now going to be virtual so that you could do a bunch of these different things and go and really truly realize the potential of being a representative republic where you're representing your people in your district. And so this article even highlights the fact that he's having true conversation on Twitter. He calls it the Twitterverse, which is instead of him, you know, going out and saying, this is what I'm doing today, or, you know, bored out on the floor, you know, those kinds of things like that, he's actually engaging. So think about it. If there's a debate that's happening right on the floor and you're watching it live, and they talk about his website as well and how the, his committee is doing all these things, you could actually send in a tweet to one of the staffers or to the representatives that are holding the hearing and say, ask this question. And that would be awesome, you know, to be able to have that kind of interaction with a congressman while a hearing is going on. And think of the impact.
I'm looking at his Twitter feed right now, and it looks like he tweets every couple of hours. There's something up here. Oh, no, they're not all from him. He tweeted 29 minutes ago, 2 hours ago, 4 hours ago, and there's a variety of topics on here, too. It's not just whatever the committee happens to be working on.
It's becoming an essential element of, you know, successful governance. I mean, people in the administration are tweeting, congressmen, senators. We've come a long way. I promised I'd give a story about a first gov. Remember, so one of the major initiatives in the Clinton administration that brought us into the new technological world was first gov and the creation of a portal. And so Congress held a hearing on first gov, and the congressman who held the hearing, name shall remain anonymous, opened the hearing by saying, we're here to talk about www, period, firstgov, period. And we've come a long way since then.
Well, that's quite a level of sophistication to have overcome. Where do you see this 2 years from now, 5 years from now, or is it even possible to think that far out given the way technology changes?
Well, the one piece that he did highlight in this was Madison, which was the new technological solution that's going to allow the crowdsourcing for legislation. So, you know, to me, where I think the big change is going to happen, and K Street's going to have a heart attack with some of the stuff I'm going to say right now, that if you interact with this technology, the idea and the role of K Street, right, is really going to change because you can influence legislation. You can get things done. So everything that we've been talking about, for example, shared services, how appropriations are done, how things are done, this will allow for them to hear directly from their constituency, like, yeah, why do we have 5 or 6 or 20 different contracts for the same type of thing? Why is the government providing this type of service? Why don't they do certain types of things, which will allow that penetration into and maybe allow some information sharing across the committees on the Hill? So that integration happens up there. And so I'm hoping that if they really embrace this technology, they'll see the potential and help the agencies implement.
I would love to continue this conversation, and we're just completely out of time. Thank you both for being here. It's always great to see both of you. Dan Chenick, Senior Fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Karen Evans, former eGov Administrator. And thank you for coming in and being on the show. All of the stories that they counted down are on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Hour number two is next. Next.